Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannon with you until 3 o'clock today. Now, Tom Gilligan, Director of Services for Housing and Roads at Mayo County Council, has caused a bit of a stir. He has called for a community-led boycott of holiday home owners down there in Mayo. He says this is in order to bring high numbers of vacant properties back into use because we are, as we all know, in the middle of a housing crisis. Debbie, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Yeah, you think Tom has a point?
I don't know what his main point is, but I just know what my point is. So I wouldn't, I don't know about boycotting or anything like that. My point would be different.
Well, go, tell me tell me where you are on this then, Debbie.
I'm living on the Sheepshead Peninsula just outside Bantry.
Beautiful part of the country.
Absolutely the most beautiful part of the country, I think, my opinion.
Right.
But a major thing out here would be planning and the lack of planning for locals because of the high density of houses being built in the coastal villages and communities. And then when a local wants to build, they're told there's a high density of housing, but there's nobody living in these houses. And there's coastal communities all over Kerry, all over Galway, all over Cork, and the schools are closing. Because I know for a fact one coastal school next to, near us here had no pupils starting in 2024. And there's houses all around that school with nobody living in them. There's shops closing. They're talking about the post office on the radio all day today. There's post offices closing because there's nobody living in the communities. It's all people coming in for July and August and then they're gone. Shut up shop in September until next year again. It's just absolutely crippling the fabric of rural communities, I think.
Do you think that the people who have those houses, and obviously they don't all just come for the few weeks in the summer. I mean, I'm sure people who own some of those holiday homes, some of them must rent them out, Debbie, do they?
No. Well, a lot of them do, they probably, but I'm only talking about the ones I know about. They don't rent them out. They're fortunate enough to have a second home that they don't need to rent out. And that's their business. I've nothing against them. I wouldn't be boycotting them renting because I actually, you know some of them from our community. But it's just like football team, GA teams have trouble fielding teams because there aren't enough children living in the area. Old people don't have neighbours to support them because there's nobody living near them. These are all the things that make up rural fabrics of rural communities that we need to change the rules. And it's just not here around the Sheepshead. I've been speaking to, I was over in a rural part of Kerry in September and I was speaking to a girl, a 30-something-year-old, who lives and works there. She's been living and working there for 10 years, living with her family, and she's her eye on a house. And I said, well, why don't you go for it? She goes, oh, I will go for it, but I know who's going to buy it, she said, before I even put it, my name in. Because he has loads of money and he buys every house in that rural community. And there's nobody living in it for the winter.
And so he buys those houses and rents them out as holiday.
Rents them out for the summer. And it's just a small rural community, a beautiful place. And she said she knows who's going to buy that house before she even puts her name in to buy it. That's what you're up against.
Yeah, I mean, you can see why that would be sticking your craw big time, particularly if you're from an area like that.
Yeah.
But I suppose the other side of that, Debbie, is those areas do depend on the income that might come from those owners of holiday homes as well. Isn't that also the case?
If there's people living in the houses all year round, there would be an income from locals. Like they're talking about post offices closing in rural communities because there isn't a population there to keep them open. Like we're doing nothing to keep our own youth where they're born and raised. If they want to come back, I know people that have loads of land and they could not get planning for one child because of the high density of housing.
Debbie, will you hang on? Hang on for me there, Debbie. Flan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Yeah, what do you say to that, Flan?
I'm listening to it. I'm not saying that that woman doesn't have a point, but I just outline a different scenario. I'm living in Athlone, and I wouldn't like to mention the location in Kerry, because I think the whole nature of the article by the senior official with Mayo County Council, I think it could embolden, I'm not accusing him of it, but it could embolden more extreme views. We started, a group of us from Athlone, friends of mine, we started holidaying in a very small location in southwest Kerry. And all I'll say about it is not far from Valentia Island. We started holidaying down there around 1976, camping on the beach. And several people from Athlone, there's some people from Athlone that I mightn't meet at all in Athlone that I'd meet down there. But in 1998, I bought a site and I built a house on it. I used all local labour and all associated goods were purchased locally. And I have to say, all the workers, all local workers, they were the most honourable workers I ever dealt with. And many of them became regular personal friends. I just say, as regards our involvement in the local community, to give you an idea, in the local community down there, back a number of years ago, they decided to arrange for funding for an inshore rescue boat. And a few of us from Athlone, we decided we'd get involved to support that. And we raised, in one function alone in Athlone, we raised in the region of around €7,000, which was a very significant part of the total cost of the scheme. Many others of us that I know who have, I would call it a second home. I would say we'd be involved in support of local issues such as the local GA club and a weekly draw. And I thought one of the things that I think the senior official had said, which I think I just couldn't believe it, is that holiday homeowners are bad neighbours. Now, that's a direct quote from today's Independent, where the article is published. And I'm looking at one councillor in Mayo. I know nothing about him, but Peter Flynn is his name, a Fine Gael councillor. And in fairness to him, he said he completely disassociated himself from the comments of the senior official, and he said that the boycott is crazy. But I think because of the article that's being covered, it's very necessary to look at, there's four bullet points in the article.
Okay, but can I just say to you, Flan, because I don't have Tom Gilligan here to explain himself or defend himself on that. Could we kind of stick with the kind of overall point of it, which is you have a second home, as you say, in Kerry. How much time would you spend there?
I would spend, to give you an idea, when COVID came, very often I would spend Christmas with my extended family in Dublin. But because we couldn't travel, we couldn't mix and all that, I decided to go to Kerry for a few days over Christmas of that year. And I went down on the 23rd of December. I didn't come back till the 1st of March. Last Saturday, I came back from Kerry after spending 8 days down there. Anything that needs to be done, I get local labour to do it, and I'm doing that regularly. And I, as far as I'm concerned, we're part of the local community down there.
Sorry, Flan, just to, because that is the point that Debbie was making. Like, for how many weeks of the year would your house be empty down there?
Not many at all. Right. I'd be up and down there all year round. But just one point, and I fully accept this, and just I appreciate if you would let me make it, in regard to Mr. Gilligan. He got plenty of airtime this morning on radio to explain his position. And I actually, at first I thought to myself, I had sympathy for him. I said, God, this man is going to get himself into trouble for coming out with this. But when I heard him on Claire, I think it was Claire Burns' programme this morning, like, he had plenty of time to go into detail, and he wasn't challenged. But I think it's essential. Just the four bullet points. The one I would touch on is public campaigns, posters and community meetings encouraging solidarity. Now, anyone reading that, am I to expect that my name could be put up on a public poster because I have a holiday home? I don't rent it. I don't need to rent it. I'm not a wealthy man. I'm not a developer. I would accept it. I haven't holidayed abroad in over 40 years. Any money I spend is in Ireland, whether it's in Athlone or in Kerry.
Have you ever had any kind of sense at all that you weren't welcome in all the time
Absolutely
you've been in Kerry?
Not. Absolutely not. And even to the extent that even if it was a family bereavement, many friends of mine will come up and did, as I would go down there, come up to the funeral. It's a personal thing, very much a personal thing. I'm not disputing the points that that woman made. I fully accept that. But at the same time, to give a bit of balance to it, I think it was a very divisive approach. And, you know, a public meeting, what would a public meeting entail? Would it entail council officials going and telling people to put up posters? Or would the council say, no, we leave it to yourselves? And I think the council's own response was very watery as well, and it's not part of official council.
I was just going to say that was made clear that it wasn't an official council
issue. That's not good enough. But the man, the Fine Gael councillor, who said he completely disassociated himself, I fully respect that, and I would agree with that 100%.
Okay, will you hang on, Flann? I've got Mary. Yeah. Mary on another line here. Mary, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Very well, Mary. Where would you stand on this?
Okay, well, I was just absolutely shocked when I heard this all starting off on the radio this morning. I just couldn't believe it, to be honest with you, because like your two previous callers, we're all coming from a different angle, in my opinion. Now, I would be a person that would actually travel to all these holiday homes around Ireland because I don't go abroad. I have two special needs kids. And to me, it's even difficult, I have to say, in this present climate to actually get a pet-friendly holiday home. And I mean, I would be all over Ireland. I just wouldn't be just in one particular, say, in Kerry or wherever. It would be Connemara, Galway, Donegal, you name it. We've been there, Cork, Kerry. And I just feel when this is coming out, they were mentioning 6,000 holiday homes. But how do you class a holiday home, if you know what I mean? Like, from my point of view and from a lot of my friends, we have great difficulty even securing a holiday home within a budget for our families to travel because we don't go abroad. So, you know, shut down an area and explain to people about being bad neighbours. Like, anywhere I have gone in Ireland, they are so happy and so welcoming. I would hate that to kind of be put on the back burner because someone now has decided that, you know, we have to bring all these homes back into use. I just wonder. I really wonder.
Yeah, Debbie, we still have Debbie there, don't we?
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, Debbie, that, I mean, I know you say that the houses you're looking at are you know, in use for a very short length of time every summer. But
These are not rentals. These are houses that people come from mostly abroad and just stay for. Like, there's rentals around, and those people that rent those houses go into the shops, they buy groceries, they go to the pubs, they participate. But I would have nothing at all against people coming renting houses, absolutely nothing.
But Flann's situation, where he has that house, and obviously he's very involved in the community.
Well, you see, he's a different story. You can't paint everyone with the one brush.
Yeah.
But, you know?
Yeah. But I would say a lot of people who come to, you know, have second homes like that, if we put it like that, would consider themselves to be part of that other community as well.
Maybe they do. I'm just telling you my point of view.
Yeah. Well, you hang on to that, Mary, please. And Mary, hang on. And we'll take a quick break. We'll be back after these.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we are going to come back to that debate on holiday homes and second homes. They're kicked off, of course, by Tom Gilligan, who was actually on Morning Ireland this morning. And I think, fair to say, challenged as well on that programme. But we will, as I say, come back to that. So keep those calls coming in. I want to break for a minute now and talk to James. So, James, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Katie. How you doing?
James, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Good, yeah.
Now, I know you from work, James, and I must say, I was surprised to hear that you were a Coldplay fan.
yeah, a little bit.
Okay, so you must be a Coldplay fan, James, because you were at their concert last summer.
I was indeed, yeah, I was at the concert on Friday, the 29th of August, yeah. lovely day it was, weather-wise.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was one of those concerts last summer that a lot of people were talking about. Even people who wouldn't have been big Coldplay fans, it apparently was a brilliant day, a brilliant concert.
Yeah, well, that's what I heard. Unfortunately for me, it wasn't. But myself and my wife, yeah, we had a disaster of an experience, to be honest with you, and one that wasn't memorable.
Okay, well, talk me through it then. You got the tickets online?
Yeah, basically, we got the tickets. I was trying to figure out what date it was that we bought the tickets, but it was during the artist pre-sale. So it was before the general public got their hands on the tickets. And went to the concert, as I said, on the 29th. Was sort of, when we got to Croke Park, we were, you know, went in and we got these armbands. People would know if they're at the concert, which were, you know, they were part of the show, so to speak, the light show.
Oh, they lit up,
Yeah, they lit up and all that sort of stuff. So very excited. We went down to, walked up the steps in the lower Hogan stand to where the stewards were, and they instructed us to, you know, they showed us to our seats, escorted to the seats, and we sat down and we sort of looked at the set, and we were just in disbelief at what we were seeing, I suppose, or what we weren't seeing.
So, yeah, explain, what was your view?
The view was basically, the best I could describe it was, it was like a slab of concrete in front of us, like at eye level, which was obstructing a lot of the set. Down on the pitch. The pitch was elevated, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So the people, you know, in the standing positions on the pitch, I suppose, could see the set. But we had this overhang from the upper Hogan stand coming down and was right at eye level, obstructing the view.
And were you have been the only seats that would have been affected by that? Or?
No. We were in block 330. And we were four rows from the back. We were about on the halfway line, if it was a GAA pitch, so to speak.
Yeah.
And we were about four rows from the back. So everyone behind us in the four rows actually had even worse vantage point because they were up higher again.
And could you like crane your neck around to see?
Yeah, well, basically, I was sort of lucky in the sense that my seat was on the aisle. So I could sort of crouch in the seat and bend to my left-hand side, sort of obstructing the aisle, but still sitting in my seat. And I could sort of get a little bit of a better view. But that sort of all changed when Coldplay actually came on.
Why?
Well, basically, when Coldplay came on, everybody stood up, first of all, the people in front of us. So that in turn meant that we had to stand up because we were just looking at their backs. And then with the excitement and everything, and with the people behind us not being able to see practically anything, I would imagine, they all flooded into the aisle beside us and were jumping and dancing and all the rest of it and trying to get vantage points and all that sort of stuff. And it just made our view even worse, you know.
So did you stick it out for the whole concert in that situation?
Well, in turn, we went down to, after about six songs, there was three girls sitting in the seats just in front of us, and they were in the same situation as us, basically. And one of the girls looked back at me, and we were pretty irate at this stage, and we said we'd go down to the stewards and try and clear the aisle, at least that we might have a bit of, you know, a small bit better view. So we walked down to the stewards and told them, and we said, well, what's the situation with people standing in the aisle? And they said, oh no, it's not allowed. And I said, well, do you want to look back and have a look there? And they said, okay. So they walked up with us up the aisle, and they started ushering people, telling people, you know, get back to the seats. So all those people that were standing in the aisle were put back up behind us. And
And they knew it was your fault now.
Well, of course, because we were the steward walked right up behind us. So, it was very fairly obvious. Yes. So then just the vibe completely turned then, like, you know, and I sort of don't really blame the punters. You know, they were just trying to, they were put in an awful situation of also buying tickets that had a restrictive view. You know, you know, it's hard to sort of blame them either. It's Ticketmaster, you know.
And what did they say? So, like, when you say the vibe changed?
There was bits of litter being thrown and, you know, cups on the ground being kicked down and all that sort of stuff. And then when anybody sort of had filed by to maybe go to the bar or the toilet, you know, walking back up, there was dagger looks and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it just sort of made the whole thing very unpleasant, yeah.
Yeah, persona non grata.
Yeah.
So how much had you paid for the tickets, James?
So we paid 332. And as I said, you know, the important thing that it was in the pre-sale, within the artist pre-sale, you know, which sort of is beggar's belief that we would have got such terrible seats, you know, which, you know, the whole point being, if they had been advertised or if during the whole purchase process, it had been told to us that they were restrictive view seats, fair enough. But no, we were sold seats, you know, that were meant to be of good quality, non-restrictive view.
Now, I'm sure this has happened. I mean, obviously it does happen because people end up in those seats or other seats all the time with restricted views. As you say, sometimes you buy them, you get a cheap deal with restricted view seats. But you decided not to let it lie after it.
Yeah, I was furious. I was absolutely furious. Like, you know, I literally wanted to go after a couple of songs. My wife was like, just try and stick it out here. It might get better or whatever. And I was like, God almighty. But
I feel like, James, we could be doing an interview with your wife. Would be slightly might even be more interesting right now for this part of it.
But we left after during the last song, I think, or the second last song. And it was probably the best 30 seconds of the whole concert for me was the walk down and out, because I was walking down the aisle towards the exit, you got a full view of the stadium and the light show and everything. And it was unbelievable. It was spectacular. And that made me more enraged, because I was just like, this is what we missed out on, all this. Like, it was, you know, as I said, that was the best part of the whole show, that 30 seconds of walking out. So basically during the walk, we sort of walked home most of the way. And during that walk, I started constructing the email to Ticketmaster. I was fuming, absolutely fuming. So I sent that first email to them on the Monday, the 31st, outlining my concerns and my annoyance. Mm-hmm. And they got back to me, about 2 weeks later, sort of saying, they told that you need to contact a promoter, that it had nothing to do with them, i.e. MCD.
Right.
Yeah. So I was sort of like, at that stage, I was like, okay, contact MCD. So contact MCD, went through the whole rigmarole. I lodged my claim in a small claims against them, and they said that it was going to be rejected because I had to take it against Ticketmaster.
Right. So Ticketmaster told you that it was MCD was responsible, and when you actually went to hold them to account in the small claims court, the court said no. Actually, your contract is with Ticketmaster.
Yeah, exactly.
So then you went after Ticketmaster?
Then I went after Ticketmaster. I was even more furious. It was like a red rag to a bull, to be honest with you. I was so irate that they had given me the runaround and all that sort of stuff. And then they wrote back on the 12th of December saying that they had insufficient detail to investigate the matter further. And like, this was absolute baloney, because I had already lodged a complaint with all the details that Monday, that very first Monday after the gig. So that was just a load of baloney, as I said. So then on the 25th of March, I think it was, I got a letter from the small claims saying that I had a court date on the 19th of May.
And how does that work then? Do you need a solicitor if you're going through the small claims court?
No, it's quite good. Well, I didn't really know much about it. It was my first one, really. So they organised it all. In fairness to them, in the small claims, they were very, very good. They very easy to deal with. Like, you just fill out a form and all the rest of it. But like, any time I contacted them over the phone or via email, I got an immediate response and all that. So they were very, very efficient and, you know, easy to deal with. They were great, to be honest.
And on your court date then?
Yeah, and the court date was on Monday. So arrived up to the court.
Had you been, just to be clear about this, had you been offered any refund at or any compensation?
Oh, apologies. Apologies. Yeah, I was. Oh. After, on the 25th, after I lodged the complaint or officially to them, a few days later, a letter had come in to the small claims court with the offer of €190. And I don't know how they came up with that figure or whatever it was, but they said it was the price of two lowest fare tickets, so to speak. So that's what they were saying. Mm-hmm. But I just wasn't interested in it. I wanted my money back. I really felt like I didn't get paid. I didn't get what I paid for.
Yeah,
so I wanted
your day in court.
I was just... Not even that I wanted my day in court, because to be honest with you, if they'd offered me the money there and then for the full refund, I would have taken it. And I still would have taken it outside the court, to be honest with you. I just wanted my money back. I was just so furious. But they didn't even offer that. And more to the point, they didn't even turn up in court.
So on court, you were there, you explained to the judge... You know,
we judge called me up. There was five cases that day, or seven cases. We were the fifth. Judge called us up and sort of said, "Is any representative from Ticketmaster?" There was nobody, so he just went through all the documents, and I presented my evidence again and photographs and all the rest of it. And he asked a fair few questions. In fairness. But in the end, he sort of said that he wasn't here to defend Ticketmaster, and they're not there to defend themselves. So we award you what you want.
So your final award was?
The final award was full refund of 332.
Right, 332.
Yeah.
What did that feel like, James?
Oh, it was great. Yeah, it was really good. As I said, it was a very long process. It was the guts of 9 months now or something like that. So, no, I was delighted, to be honest with you. Thrilled.
I mean, there must have been a sense of satisfaction, because when you've been given the runaround like that...
As I said, it was the runaround and how difficult they made the whole process, like... From the first time logging it, like I couldn't get a proper email address to send my complaint or anything like that. You had to log on to their automatic sort of ticketing system. You know, you don't get really talking to anyone, and you could be waiting a few weeks for a reply, and then it's impossible to contact anyone, you know. So just getting the runaround was very, very frustrating.
Okay, well, congratulations anyway. You stuck with it. Your tenacity paid off in the end, James. And Ticketmaster won't tangle with you again.
Well, hopefully not. Well, yeah.
James, thanks for that. Take care.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, listeners to Liveline, regular listeners, will be very well acquainted with the long saga around the granting of the provision of free HRT. This was a big announcement in the budget, and we are, I don't know, how many months are we on down the road now? And we're told as of last Friday that it has been agreed now, but many pharmacies were still waiting for it to actually be rolled out. So that was that. The other big announcement to that budget was that the provision of free IVF treatment was going to be expanded, because in 2023 there was free IVF introduced for the first time, but it was for a very, very limited criteria. This was going to be expanded. So, Elva, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
Very well, Elva. So tell me your own story first about this. You have a 4-year-old son, Elva.
I do, yes. My husband and I have a 4-year-old son who was conceived very easily and then a year later started trying for our second baby, and we are 3 years trying now unsuccessfully. So we have secondary infertility, unexplained secondary infertility.
Yeah, and this was, and then in terms of the IVF provision that Stephen Donnelly was talking about,
yes.
So take us back, 2023, it was rolled out for couples with, as we say, very strict criteria. So you had to be age between 18 and 40 if you were the woman. You couldn't have any living children with your partner. And you had to be in a relationship for a year, and there was issues about BMI as well. You had to be under between a certain BMI.
Correct.
So because, of course, you already had a child.
Yes.
That was no good.
I was not eligible, and I was, you know, that was fine with me. I knew I wasn't eligible with something like this, a free round of IVF scheme. It's an amazing thing to do, and people without children should absolutely be first in line. So when they rolled out in 2023, I knew I wasn't eligible, so I just knew that wasn't an option. Then budget 2025 is announced October last year, and they said that they had made the funds available to expand the criteria to include couples with secondary infertility, so couples that already have a child together. And that was an amazing thing to hear. You know, it was this huge kind of weight off our shoulders that this might be something that we could avail of. And
because Elva, just to explain to people as well, like, you had already spent a lot of your own funds trying to get pregnant again.
Yeah. So at that stage, it had been over 2 years trying, and we right now, I just did the maths, and we've spent €15,000 of our own money on tests and treatments and prescriptions and everything like that, trying to figure out what is happening and why it's happening. And we haven't done IVF yet. So that's 15,000 before IVF.
Yeah. So, yeah, you must have been thrilled then when you heard that budget announcement.
Yeah. It was amazing. And so right away, you know, I went to my doctor, because to get the free IVF, it's managed through the HSE's fertility hubs in Ireland. So there's 6 fertility hubs. So you have to go to your GP and get an application submitted to the fertility hub. So I did that right away, actually, in November, just because I was very aware of the waiting lists being very, very long. So I knew they wouldn't get to my application till 2025. So I went to the doctor, got my application submitted, and it was actually rejected because of my BMI. It was too low, and I had to, they just said no, and they said you can gain the weight and reapply. So I did that. So a month later, I went back to the doctor, paid to see the doctor again, got my application resubmitted, and then in January received acknowledgement of my application from the fertility hub, and got application forms to kind of proceed with the application. So I filled those in, sent them off, and then in March got an appointment letter for May 7th. So that would be 6 months from the start of the application to the first appointment, which was 2 weeks ago.
Right. So in Iraq 2 weeks ago, delighted with yourself, thinking finally we're getting there. Do you mind me asking what age you are, Elva?
I'm 38, so it is, you know, time is not on my side at all. When it comes to for fertility in general, so that's a concern, and we'd already waited 6 months at this stage, and you know, I was hoping that it would move pretty quickly for us because we had had all the tests done to date. You know, I came prepared with, you know, printouts of every single test we've had ready to show the doctor to kind of get the ball rolling on stuff, which obviously, you know, she started going through and she started asking all the questions that were already in the application form, you know, trying to, you know, probably, you know, validate the answers. That's fine. We're going through them all. And then she says to me, so you've never been pregnant before? I said, well, you know, yes, I have a child, so I have been pregnant before. You know, how she missed that in the application form, I'm not sure. But right away she just said, you're not eligible. which, you know, was just kind of like you could hear a pin drop in the room. It was just such a kind of a shock to the system that we had got that far and we were sitting down there with her. And then she said, well, no, sorry, you know, there's nothing we can do for you.
Your heart must have sank so badly.
Yeah. It was really disheartening because, you know, something that I've been trying to kind of stress when I'm talking about this is that this wasn't a campaign trail promise. You know, governments break these promises that they make all the time when they're trying to get elected. This was announced in the budget. We're halfway through the year and nothing has been done about it. You know, so the doctor said, look, we had a meeting on this last week. We've received no communication from the Department of Health. We don't know when this is going to start. Because, you know, like I pushed back and I said, well, you know, we're supposed to be eligible this year. And she said, I'm sorry, like we don't have any information on that. We don't know what the criteria would be. There's been no movement on that promise and moving it into legislation. So we were discharged and that's it, you know.
We asked the HSE, I have a statement here from the HSE in relation to this, and they confirm, we asked, what is the criteria for people availing of this scheme? They said the criteria associated with the expansion of the scheme to include couples experiencing secondary infertility is currently being finalised, is what they say.
Right.
They say that when we ask, when will the scheme become available to couples who have secondary infertility like you? They say the HSE is currently engaging with the Department of Health in relation to the ongoing management of the publicly funded assisted human reproduction treatment scheme. They say this includes consideration of issues associated with the expansion of access criteria and or the specific services provided. They say this process may take some time.
Right. Yeah. So why announce it in the budget in 2025 that they were going to do it, you know, if they hadn't even had the conversations yet? It just, it boggles my mind. You know, they've got so many people's hopes up and they can't give any information as to when this will happen. And fertility is a ticking time bomb, you know, like I'm 38, I can't wait any longer. I've had to make arrangements to do IVF abroad, and as soon as I got that no, I started taking that action, you know.
So that you have actually already taken those steps, Alva, yeah?
Yeah, right away. As soon as they said no, it was a straight up no, and it was you know, even if the eligibility changed in the next few weeks, she said I'd have to go back to the start and apply again because I was being discharged from the fertility hub. So, you know, I can't wait another 6 months. So I, you know, as soon as that happened, myself and my husband had a conversation and we decided we were going to move forward with IVF out of the country where it's more affordable.
And obviously it is more affordable. We know that in lots of centres abroad, but it's still very expensive.
It is. Yeah. No, it's not cheap by any stretch of the imagination. And logistically, it's not ideal either. You know, having to juggle that all with work and everything else. So it's not what we want to do, but we really, really want to give our son a sibling, and IVF is what we have to do. We've been told that is what we have to do now. So,
do you mind me asking, Alva, because you have a child, and I know you feel so lucky to be in that situation. But do you think people appreciate how difficult it can be then when you then discover when you then realise you have secondary infertility?
I think that there's not enough people that talk about secondary infertility, and I think that's for a number of reasons. And you do encounter that mentality of, oh, you should be lucky for what you have, you know. And 100%, I feel so lucky, but at the same time, that longing for another child doesn't go away, and it is heartbreaking, regardless of what kind of infertility you have, primary or secondary. It is devastating every month when, you know, it doesn't go your way, and it consumes your life. It really does. It messes with your head. You're taking a lot of medication. Your hormones are all over the place, and your life is kind of in limbo because you feel like you can't really plan anything, because what if it happens? What if it happens? What if it happens? So it takes over your life completely, regardless of whether you have a child or not. infertility is just one of the most horrible journeys.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for sharing. It's such a personal issue. I do really appreciate people who can tell their own story, because it does, it makes other people understand what's going on for you and opens up conversations for other people. So thank you for that, genuinely, Alva. And the very best of luck to you both.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care. And if we hear any more on that, we will, of course, bring it to you. But I want to go back to concerts now. We were hearing from James there before the break. Kathy, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you? Just listening to James there just brought me right back to the exact same experience we had at a concert in Croke Park. So I can reiterate everything he's saying. We were actually in the very back row, so we couldn't see anything at all except the edge of the pitch. It was awful. Yeah, we had paid full price tickets, most expensive tickets I think I'd ever bought at that point in time, about 7 years ago. The only way that we could see is if you put your head fully on your knees and turned your head sideways, you got a kind of a moment's glimpse of the big screen kind of that was on as part of the set. So I was so mad. I was so mad.
Whose concert was it?
It was Bruce Springsteen. It was Bruce Springsteen, and it was in Croke Park. And the concrete overhang was just from the top, the tier above us, was completely and utterly blocking the view of everybody around us as well. It wasn't just us.
And had you been given any indication that you had restricted view tickets when you bought them?
No, we kind of went for a bit of an upgrade. We said we'd spoil ourselves. So not at all. No, not at all. So that, I think that was the frustration. If you knew that you could be in a bit of a dodgy viewing situation, that would be different. But so I was so mad. I think I sent one email afterwards and, life gets in the way, and I didn't chase it like James did, but I admire him very much. But I would say that was about 7 years ago.
Yeah, I'd say
I've never bought a ticket since.
Your statute of limitations is probably up on that one, Kathy. I would say.
I think it is. But it was he brought it all back. So it was only just to say, it's a very real disappointment, a very real disappointment. And you look forward to these concerts, especially if you're a fan. And that was it. I just spoke with my feet. I didn't buy another one. I'm happily down in Cork, and I've seen him in Parky Creeve. So how bad? Yeah, that was perfect.
Okay, Kathy. Thanks for that. And I'm sure, as you say, you're not alone. Obviously, there's those seats must be, they obviously sell tickets for those seats all the time. So there must be many more like yourself. Thanks for that, Kathy. We'll take a break.
Joe Duffy. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, yesterday we were talking to school secretaries. They had a long campaign to be recognised as public service staff. Finally, in September 2023, the Department of Education provided a payroll service for secretaries. So therefore, they began being paid not just by the school, but by the Department of Education. They're still fighting to be included in the pension scheme that the other staff in the schools can avail of, that's a long running issue for them. But caretakers is the other class of staff member in schools that are still fighting for proper conditions. Maurice, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Katie. Thanks for having me on.
Lovely to talk to you. How long have you been a caretaker, Maurice?
Just going on 8 years now. So, 8 years. It flies, but it's 8 years, I've been told.
And how did you get into that line of work?
Well, my wife would have been in, she's actually in the school as a principal. So, and I had qualifications, as in, I have an engineering background, and we had a young child, so it made sense for me to take on something part-time. And so I ended up and I knew the school fairly well, so I ended up blending into the role of caretaker. So, and it's a very multi-task job, as in, there's so much. To put it on a list what a caretaker does, it's really impossible. There's clean landscaping, a bit of carpentry, plumbing, gardening. The list goes on. And then we have lots of activities. We help out with school plays. We design stuff. You're part of a big family team when it comes into the school, and that includes I could work weekends, evening work, because if I can't get into the school for a certain grass cutting, I'll go into weekends. But we don't get the same pay or anything. So we go beyond, because we always see the school as a family, and you know, we would never let them down. Like, it's not like any other job whereby, oh, I'm finished, I clocked out. When you're in the caretaker and you're like a big family, you go the extra mile. So it is very hard when people don't realise that we're not paid by the Department of Education. We're completely, I have to, for 3 months, then when the school closed down for 2 months, I'd have to go and sign on, and I wouldn't get full rate. So it is really very hard to actually, financially, only for my wife works, but I could not function in the job that I love, because if I was a young person to get a house, I could not. It would be impossible for me to stay in that kind of a job. And it's very unfair, considering that we're treated, everybody else thinks that we're all on the same par, but we're not. So it's crazy.
In much the same way, and I was saying this when I was talking to your colleagues, school secretary colleagues yesterday, like, yeah, secretaries and caretakers, I think, are kind of the beating heart of schools. They're the go-to people for parents, for teachers, for students. Yeah. And I know, like, in my own kid's school, the caretaker is the star turn in the Christmas concert. It's as you say, it's way above and beyond, like, fixing the plumbing.
Oh yeah, I mean, I dress up for Easter. I dress up as an Easter bunny every year. Then I have a Rupert Bear outfit that I put on when the kids are coming in to start the year. I even have a Frosty the outfit. So what caretakers do is beyond, like, it's really, because we really go beyond. And I meet a lot of caretakers every second year. We have to recertify ourselves. And there's no young generation coming up because of the pay, and because of there's no pension parity. So when I go and retire, there's nobody else coming in to fill these positions. So we are sort of a dying trade. And it is so, schools, and they know us. We'd be on call if there's keys lost or if there's alarm going off. Security will ring me. And there's contractors on site to contact me. It's a huge array that we do for the school. But not to be on the same level with the teachers who really support us, what we're doing, it's really crazy. And it's unknown for most people. Think, no, I didn't know that. And they don't.
To be honest with you, I only became aware of the school secretaries and when they were, you know, campaigning to get their conditions and employment status sorted out. But I assumed that caretakers had come in under that change. So I was surprised to see this. Now, we asked again and we said, well, you know, what is the story with this? We put some questions into the Department of Education. And they said, in relation to school caretakers, the department is committed to ensuring the school caretakers will be afforded the opportunity to avail of a similar package offered to school secretaries in the near future.
Yeah, unfortunately, caretakers are we're quite, but essential part of school. Like, we're there in the hours when the school is closed, we're there. But because a lot of the colleagues I would deal with, they'll go the extra mile without saying, no, I'm not turning up for work today, I don't care, I'm fighting this. So we're the last ones who actually would ever want to go on a strike, because we see the school as part of our family, as our home. And so I think it's terrible that the Department of Education know that we're not standing outside gates, because we're not that kind of a people. We like to get on and do a job, but we like to get paid and have the same equals that everybody else has in the school. I think sometimes we are treated because we're too quiet. We don't shout enough. Yeah. And we are sort of a unique breed in that, oh, we're always there, but these lads don't really shout that much. They're really quiet. They just, you know, to get on with it. But it is not fair nowadays with the price of everything. And just off me, I'm 54, so another 11 years, I have literally looking at no pension coming into, and the pay, it is so vague, and they're very slow to react and come on. They're sort of hoping that we just forget about it. But at this time, you know, we've been fighting a long cause, and with force and everything else, and the secretaries, and like as is, everybody, teacher will say, we are a part of them. We are literally a one big family, yeah. And it's terrible that we have to be not recognised in parity with the rest of, you know, in
the school community. So, yeah.
Stay
there, Maurice. I've got Damien on the other line. Damien, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, so you are, you've been a caretaker for, is it 12 years? Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's right. 12 years, yeah.
And you're close to retirement yourself at this stage, are you?
I'd have another year to do, I suppose. I'm 65, so I'd have another year to do. But I might continue on to do more after that if my health is good enough to do it.
And how did you get into it, Damien?
Katie, I got into it when the financial crash happened. Like a lot of caretakers, I'd say a good portion of us would be coming from the construction industry. And I was in that industry, civil engineering technician and safety officer later on. And when that happened, a lot of firms let people go, etc. So that changeover happened for me then, you know.
Yeah. And do you like it?
I love it. I absolutely love it. And that I feel that we're valued, very much valued in the school with the teachers. And that it's lovely to hear a thank you. It's lovely to be able to do something, you know, to be able to fix things. We're called on to fix an awful lot of things. And that is, as your caller just said there, you know, plumbing, gardening, all of that, carpentry and all of that. That's all the stuff that we do generally on top of our daily routines. You know, we've a lot of stuff left over now, for instance, from COVID, and that COVID tested everybody. But like caretakers, we had to put up a whole lot of sanitizers and towel dispensers and all of that. But also, because of some of the systems that came in then, they found the systems work. Like, for instance, the pods and the cells and all of that. And that I would have to put out lots of cones now in the yard in the morning to create safe spaces. And as we found that it's a calming effect on the children, and it works very well. So there's a lot of carryover and stuff from COVID that I still have to do on top of my daily routine, you know.
And I know you've taken on the garden now as well, haven't you, Damien?
Katie, we have a beautiful garden, and I'd like to say our school is Caerdavan Girls' School in Limerick, and at Mary Queen of Ireland. And I can say that we have a garden that would do well in bloom, and that it's a beautiful garden, and it's a courtyard garden that I maintain to the best of my ability. It was laid out by a lady called Anne Windrum, who passed away a short time ago. She did a fantastic job. And it's more than a garden. It's like a courtyard garden, and it works as a sensory room out in nature. You can hear the bird song and, like today, and that sunshine when we get it. It's absolutely fabulous. So I really do enjoy what I do. But somebody said to me there when I started, Damien, you're ideal for that job, and that you're as handy as a pot. Handy as a pot, he said to me. And I smiled at him, knowing exactly what he meant, you know. And our caretakers, our pot is that we come with a set of skills that we've gained throughout our life. Like no young man can take up this job, or no man that's supporting a family can take up this job, because the income and whatever is there for them wouldn't support that. You know, you wouldn't be able to, instance, go and talk to somebody about a mortgage, et cetera, because they wouldn't entertain you. They wouldn't let you in the door. And that. So, you know, we do come with a very high skill set and all of that. And we give a lot of goodwill. And like your last caller said there, we're very slow to say no to anything. If we can do it and it's within our capabilities, we will do it, unless it's specialist work. And we are the first port of call for the principal. The principal is like a person who running their own business, because they have restraints with their funding, etc. And if they think their caretaker can fix it, they're going to come running to the caretaker straight away, you know, whether it's furniture, fixings, plumbing, you name it, lighting or whatever, and that. Yeah. And we do it. And that, but unfortunately, that goodwill is not extended at the end of the day. And that's wherein FORSA and our caretakers are now trying to make a stand. We're not getting a fair shake of the sauce. You know, we're not even included at the table, basically. We open up, we do everything for security, to include people, to make access to the building and all of that. But yet, at the end of the day, Katie, we're locked out. The system has us locked out. We're not entitled to anything. And like that handy pot, at the end of the day, there isn't much thought about the handy pot. It's discarded, you know. And you know, it's time for us to really say, look, we deserve better than that, you know.
You're worried, and I, of course you would be worried about your pension because you're getting to that stage. Yeah,
of course we would. Like coming up through the construction industry, everybody will tell you, like, you know, young people when you get into construction or other jobs, you know, pension is left something like the, oh, it's years and years and years away, you know, and that, and it's left on the long arm or whatever. But in the construction industry in particular, it was never really proactive about it. And then eventually when it did become something, a feature, and that some good companies did put in retirement plans, etc. But for the likes of myself now or whatever, and that, a lot of that came too late, you know. You're basically, you know, you're at the last third of your career, and that, and catch up is impossible. So, you know, the value of your pension would be minimum, you know.
Yeah.
So that's basically for most of the career there would stand, you know.
Does it get you down, the fact that you know, as you say, you don't feel you're being looked after now with all you put into it?
I can say that the staff and the value and all of that, and the very good, what would you say, feeling and atmosphere in the school, and that, yeah, in the school that I'm in particular, it would be impossible to get down, and that, so I don't get down. I don't get down. At the same time, I feel that the system is not doing what it should do. You know, we are public service workers, but we're not
treated that way.
Appropriately with that.
Morris, you were trying to
because I think if any young person came out with qualifications and I showed them what the job entails and the pay slip, they'd run a mile. They'd laugh at me and say, "Are you seriously want us to do all that and on that pay? How am I ever going to even afford a loan for a car?" So what they're not looking at, the longer venture, when we all retire, there's nobody coming up to fill the vital positions that schools. Because unless they're going to pay huge contractors coming in, and even them, they're not on call 24/7. So it's really, they're shooting something that have really, really, were above and beyond what we paid for. But if they're not looking at the long picture, that when we go and retire, there's nobody else coming in behind us. There's nobody knocking at the door. There is nobody, not for the pay, to look at the pay. The young lads or any young girl will look and say, I couldn't even get a loan for that and anything. And no, so it's really, they're shooting themselves in the long foot when schools are so essential for our young generation. So that is one thing that they're not looking at.
Morris, thank you for that. And Damon, can I say, you're two of the happiest men in your jobs I have ever, despite that. I have rarely talked to people who clearly absolutely love what they do every day.
Yes.
But as you say,
that should be
rewarded properly. Thanks for that, Morris. Thanks, Damon. Take care.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we were talking there at the top of the programme about that call by the Director of Services of Mayo County Council for a boycott of holiday homes to bring, just because of the housing crisis, and basically to try and bring the number of vacant properties down. Mary, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm grand, Mary, but I believe this has seriously annoyed you.
Well, I just feel it's a little bit unfair to people who have holiday homes.
In what way exactly?
Well, you know, holiday homes are houses that people have purchased. They pay local property tax, and if they don't spent, I think it's 30 days a year, their local property tax is multiplied by 7.
Is that the way? I wasn't familiar with that rule. But mind you, who's counting the days that people are spending in these houses?
Well, that's a good question. You have to keep records. And but I just feel we're seen as pariahs, is the best way I could put it.
Do you have a holiday home, Mary?
I do, yes.
And I'm very
lucky to have it, and I don't mean to be smug in any manner, shape or form.
No. Well, but I wonder, has this become a kind of a moral issue almost? Because I have seen this discussed elsewhere, the idea that having two homes in a housing crisis is somehow, you know, a moral question now.
But I don't understand why you're asking me this moral question.
Oh, I'm just saying that has it become something that people are kind of uncomfortable about? The fact that we know so many people are so desperately trying to get on the property ladder, to get a roof over their head, that...
Have we gone into a country or a state where if someone is able to have, and very luckily have, there is a problem by them having it?
I'm just throwing that out there. Have you come across any judgment on it or anything like that?
Well, I just thought what I heard today about Mayo was a bit odd, and maybe I'm wrong in what I'm saying, but I should explain that I have never been on the National Airwaves before, and I am very nervous. And but I'm just saying that I think people need to take account of, you know, it's not like everyone is very rich, or and I'm not rich. But I'm just trying to say that, you know, holiday homes are not pariahs. We give to the community in the area, and I just found it bad.
I'm sure you're not alone, Mary. I'm sure a lot of people who have holiday homes and would feel like, as you say, we were talking to Flan earlier on in the programme, and he was talking about how much they put into the community that they have there, where they holiday, and that many others do the same. Would you spend much time in the holiday home, Mary?
I do, yes. And I've spent a lot of time down there this year, and I've had a lot of works done in the house, and they've all been local people that have done those works. So, I mean, you know, I don't mean I'm contributing to the area, but I mean, I always try and get people who are working and living locally to do those works. So, I just feel there's a nastiness there.
Yeah. No, and I do appreciate you coming on, Mary. We couldn't have a program like this if you weren't willing to come on and give us your point of view on it. But do you feel that you can? I mean, I'm sure you feel very welcome when you go to your holiday home. I'm sure nobody locally has ever given you any sense of...
No. I don't mean it like that. I love it. I cannot... There's a beach very near. I cannot wait to get down to that beach every morning with my dog. The people are lovely. But I just found what went on this morning about Mayo and boycotting. And I'm going, oh my God, boycotting. And I'm going, you know, there needs to be a balance here.
Yeah.
And I don't think there is a balance.
Well, we try to do as much balancing as we can.
No, sorry.
I know what you mean. I totally know what you mean.
I'm not talking about your programme. I'm talking about balance in society.
Absolutely. And I appreciate, as I say, I really appreciate your call, Mary. Let me bring in, I've got David on the other line. David.
Hi, Katie. How are you doing? I'm coming at this from a different angle. In so far as I don't have a holiday home, and anybody that has some fair play to them. But the council, to my way of thinking, are actually taking the onus off the fact that they're not doing their job by pointing at the holiday homes. They have so many houses around the country that are boarded up and left idle, and they're doing nothing about those. They don't need planning permission for them. They don't need to do anything. Just go in and do the work and put people into them. That would alleviate a lot of problems in the housing section. There's something like 30,000 houses that are blocked up like that. I've seen them every day of the week.
Yeah, I know the Taoiseach was talking about this, I think, just last week, wasn't it? And I know that there was explanations about, you know, how it's not as simple as you might think. But you think that it'd be more in their line to be looking after their own houses before they start pointing the finger at holiday houses?
Absolutely, because the holiday houses, in some cases, are generating income for the people who own them, which is going back into the state coffers again. You know, whereas the ones that are lying idle are doing nothing, they're just going into dereliction. And I have heard the excuses that the councils make about doing these houses up. And to be honest with you, they're very hollow as far as I'm concerned. You know, if people have leave houses that are they've been living in, and the council buy them and then they board them up and they're there like that for a year and a half or 2 years. That's nonsense. And that's what's happening.
Okay, David, thanks. I'm just looking at my clock here. I'm going to try and get to Jude. Jude, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you today?
Very well. Where are you on this, Jude?
Katie, I don't own the holiday home. I think it really was probably a silly thing to move out this whole conversation. These people pay their own local property tax. They're involved in their communities. You know, so are we having a discussion really because we don't want to have a discussion about why we're not sorting out dereliction, why we're not sorting out building enough homes, to pick on people who can afford to have a holiday home, and fair play to them, is unfair. And I think it's probably trying to divert a conversation that needs to be had locally regarding the policies of specific counties. And it's an unfair conversation to start, you know. And anything with the word boycott has a lot of historical meaning in Ireland. And you know, I heard it and I went, oh no, wrong word. Don't use the word boycott. It's a terrible word from all sorts of historical things in Ireland. And it's unfair. It was unfair.
Okay. Well, thanks for that, Jude. We will, just before we go, I just want to go back to a conversation that touched a lot of people yesterday. We were talking about people's bereavement and how devastated they can be when they lose a really, really much loved pet. Niamh, good afternoon.
Hello, Casey.
I don't have a lot of time, Niamh, but I did want to get to you because this reminded you of something you saw about why dogs have shorter lives than humans.
Yeah, I came across this in it was a David Attenborough fan group actually page, but I just found it really useful because they were having, it was kind of the grown-ups having the conversation about they knowing they were going to have to put their dog to sleep and forgetting that there was a child in the room, and they just asked the question, you know, why do dogs live shorter lives than humans? And the child was the one who spoke. And I suppose he was the one where he said, you know, people are born to learn how to live a good life, like being loving and kind. Well, dogs already know how to do that, so they don't need to stay as long as we do.
Okay, we're nearly out of time. Yeah. Just the top, what do the dogs, what could they teach us if they were...
Well, they teach us to always enjoy walks, to stretch before rising, and to have, you know, to play and drink lots of water. So, and to be loyal and enjoy the simple joy of a long walk. So they remind us to be in the moment. That's really their secret to happiness, I think. When someone's having a bad day, be quiet, sit close and just be there with them.
And if you want, if what you want is buried, dig until you find it. That is...
Exactly. Yeah. Words of wisdom.
Okay.
Never pretend to be someone you're not as well.
Niamh, that was lovely. Thank you so much. That's our thought for the day that we leave you with. That's all we have time for. Kieran Cullen was on sound today. Our broadcast coordinator was Sean Marram, and the series producer, Annette Egan, produced today's programme. Stand by now for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Revamp your home this May with our fresh new curtain embedding designs. Discover comfort and style for every room.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.
Thanks very much, Katie. 3 o'clock on RTE Radio 1. Time to go to our newsroom now and to Shane McGowan.